Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 10 to 23. Again.
When you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God hands them over to you and you take them captive, suppose you see among the captives a beautiful woman whom you desire and want to marry, and so you bring her home to your house. She shall shave her head, par her nails, discard her captive garb, and she shall remain in your house a full month mourning for her father and her mother. After that, you may go in to her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. But if you are not satisfied with her, you shall let her go, and you will not sell her for money. You must not treat her as a slave, since you have dishonored her. If a man has two wives, one of them loved and the other disliked, and if both the loved and the disliked have borne him sons, the firstborn being the son of the one who is disliked, then on the day when he wills his possessions to his son, he is not permitted to treat the son of the loved as the firstborn in preference to the son of the disliked, who is the firstborn. He must acknowledge as firstborn the son of the one who is disliked, giving him a double portion of all that he has, since he is the first issue of his virility. The right of the firstborn is his. If someone has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey his father and mother, who does not heed them when they discipline him, then his father and his mother should take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of the town at the gate of that place. They shall say to the elders of the town, "This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a glutton and a drunkard." Then all the men of the town shall stone him to death. So you shall purge the evil from your midst, and all Israel will hear and be afraid. When someone is convicted of a crime punishable by death and is executed, and you hang him on a tree, his corpse must not remain all night upon the tree. You shall bury him that same day, for anyone hung on a tree is under God's curse. You must not defile the land that the Lord your God has given you for possession.
You'll notice the start of this reading, a few verses in, to where we finished last time. Effectively, in the middle of a long speech by Moses, and it's linked to the previous one, which I'll show you in a second. And what we talked about last time in chapters 19, 20, the first part of 21, is Moses' instructions to try and curb bloodshed in the land. So he's given rules for armed conflict, what you should do when there was lack of justice for somebody that had been murdered. And what he actually says in verse 9 of 21 is that the purpose of the laws and the purpose of the procedures that Moses set out was so you could purge the land of Israel from the guilt of shedding innocent blood. Innocent blood was a problem. If it was poured down the land, that blood guilt would cry out, and eventually God would no longer be present and the Israelites would be thrown out of the land. And Moses was keen to let the people know what they needed to do about this. What Moses does in our passage, verse 10, you can see that he actually links this next section with the previous one. So you'll see exactly the same words in chapter 20 and verse 1, and in chapter 10 of chapter 21. It opens with, "When you go to war against your enemies." There's a link there, and what you'll do is at the end of a passage, verse 23, you'll see that Moses' primary concern is still this issue of preventing contamination of the land. You must not desecrate the land the Lord your God is giving to you as an inheritance. That's what Moses is still focused on. And so we get to our passage. And I've given titles for these. I think they're appropriate titles. And it's interesting to know then that if this is what Moses is talking about, then effectively, by slotting in war rip in verses 10 to 14, inheritance rights in verses 15 to 17, what to do with wayward children, which is in verses 18 to 21, by slotting these in between all this bloodshed and the hanging and this protection of the land, what Moses is doing to us is implying that those crimes are as serious as murder. And in some ways that makes sense, because what we'll see as we go on to chapter 22, we're going to find out that rip is punishable by death, just as murder is. And obviously in our chapter, we can see that serious childhood rebellion is punishable by stoning. It's another death sentence. And in so in some ways it's a little bit strange. You see this this little rule about denying the inheritance to the firstborn son in verses 15 to 17, because that's not a capital offence. It's not worthy of a death sentence. But just as in the previous section, in the last one we looked at, 19 verse 14, where Moses slots in a verse about not moving boundary stones, which seems strange, what Moses appears to be having in mind, what he's reminding the Israelites of, is that his primary purpose in this section is safeguarding the land, safeguarding the inheritance. In Moses' mind, moving boundary stones, messing about with inheritance rules on a whim, they could have serious implications for the future of Israel. So I'm going to work through this passage. We've got some pretty uncomfortable topics, but they're in here, so we're going to work through them. And the first one, I've done verses 10 to 14. I've entitled this section, The Prevention of War Rip. In Judges 5, you remember Judges, where it's placed in history. This is after the Israelites have actually gone into the land, which Moses is preparing for. They've managed to conquer a lot of the land, and then it's ruled by judges, as Moses has commanded in Deuteronomy. And so Judges is immediately after, not long after this book, after the book of Joshua. And Deborah sings her songs about the battles to take the land and the tremendous victories that have been won. But in the middle of that song, in verses 28 to 30 of Judges 5, Deborah points out that their enemies, Israel's enemies, expected that men would be delayed in returning from battle while they divided the spoils among themselves. And she specifically says, a girl or two for each man. Zechariah 14:2, Isaiah 13:16 expects that rape is inevitably going to follow military conquest. It's just expected. And in some ways you might expect that this is just an extension of the bloodlust, which seems to be visible when people start killing. They seem to just get into a frenzy. You see it with dogs. People view it as an animalistic behavior. And that is like a contributing factor to this terrible crime. But it's also a long-standing tendency to view foreigners as being less than human. And certainly women that have been conquered in rape are viewed as being a fair game. But certainly viewing women as being foreigners as less than human, if you remember, if you go back to Genesis chapter 26, you can remember that Isaac is travelling with his wife Rebecca, and they've got to travel through the region of Gerar, and so they're foreigners in that land. And you remember that what Isaac does, he tells his wife Rebecca that she has to pretend that she's his sister and not his wife. And the reason, he says, is because he thought the men of this place might kill me on account of Rebecca because she is beautiful. So Isaac's expectation was that they would see his wife, lust after, and take him out of the way. So he was expecting it then. And Moses was right to be concerned in our passage. He's giving these warnings because just as Israel was susceptible to all this pagan influence and turning to idolatry, Israel would also fall into the other practices of these nations and this appalling attitude to foreign women. And Moses finds it necessary now to warn Israel and set the boundaries of Israel against it. So, and Moses is right to be worried. Because if you go to our lovely book of Ruth as well, this is also about the time of Judges, about the same time Israel have just gone into the land. All of the Jewish commentators on Ruth, in all of their midrashes, and a lot of our older commentators, all agree that Ruth chapter 2 and verses 8 to 10, what's actually happening in that passage, is that Boaz's eyes are suddenly drawn to Ruth because of her beauty, and he then becomes concerned. Because if she happens to go into another field, he's sure the workers there are going to sexually assault her. As a foreigner, she'd be viewed as fair game. And Boaz has to order his men not to touch her. And that phrase, not to touch her, it's a euphemism. We can see it used elsewhere in the Bible. Because again, back to that Isaac and Rebekah incident, King Abimelech realizes that Isaac and Rebekah are husband and wife. And what happens when we read that story in Genesis 26 is that this phrase, not to touch her, is used by the king instructing his people that they must not molest Rebekah. They mustn't touch her sexually. So this whole thing about this abuse of women, especially foreign women, is an ancient problem. It's an endemic problem. It's especially in war, but it's still just as prevalent today. In the Rotherham rape gang incidents that happened there, the attitude to foreign women is they're less than animals. In fact, it's so prevalent, there's actually an acronym for it, so you can just go onto the internet and you can search for CRSV, conflict related sexual violence, and you'll find that the UN has got a massive program trying to combat it. There are thousands of confirmed cases every year. It's happening in Ukraine. There's a Robertson report released by our own government on the October the 7th attacks of Hamas and its allies on Israel, and there are thousands of horrific incidents recorded there. It's in Myanmar, all around the place where I was supporting those missionaries there. It's in Nigeria, where that persecution of Christians is taking place. The UN are currently working in 70 different conflict zones battling against this problem of war rape and sexual crimes related to violence. Our own government has got 6 teams working in another 6 countries trying to deal with this problem. And our Bible, Isaiah, Zechariah and Judges that we looked at, shows that this behaviour is normal. It's normal in this world. And now we might sit here, and as I read it through, we're shocked and appalled by this sort of behaviour that goes on, that still goes on today. But it's really interesting, because if you can look at the UN map if you want to, but you'll find that this respect of women and respect of foreigners is a Judeo-Christian value. It's not held by everyone around the world. And sometimes you can look on this passage, and we might be appalled. A lot of people are appalled by its apparently callous view of women. But in fact, the opposite is true. So what we've actually got in this passage, and I'll show you in just a few moments, what we've actually got in this passage is a radical countercultural stance. This attitude towards women, our attitude towards women, towards foreigners, has got to be very different to the way it is in the rest of the world. So if we look at our passage here, the first thing that we can see, or you've noticed, is that there has to be a cooling off period. So if men go into battle, and if they do capture the women and children, which they're allowed to do, as we've seen in our previous passage, they cannot take them straight home to bed. What they've got to do is they've got to allow at least 1 month before they take them in as their wives. So there's this cooling off period. So there's no lustful motives, or at least they're dissipated to some extent. What also has to happen, you'll see in a passage, is there's got to be due respect given to her family and culture. She's got to be allowed time to mourn for the loss of her parents, to mourn for her home. We also see in the passage is that she has to have her feelings respected. It talks about the fact that if this man decides at some point that he wants to divorce her or send her out, that act is dishonouring her. It's bringing shame upon her. And the instruction is that she should go wherever she pleases. He cannot dictate what's happening in her life. There's a respect of her feelings. And then finally, she's not to be treated as property. She's not property. She's not a slave. She's to be a proper wife. Now, these things are radically different to the attitudes that were there at the time. Now we can look at it and we might think, oh no, this is terrible anyway. Irrespective of that, it's terrible because effectively she's being forced into a marriage against her wishes. And the trouble with that view is that we presume we know what her wishes were. The fact is that lone women were vulnerable. Boaz's concern for Ruth shows us that. He's worried about it and he wants to become her protector. Remember that under the rules of engagement that we saw in chapter 20, what happens if men have resisted going in, if they've decided they're going to fight against Israel, then what happens is that all the men are killed. That leaves the women and the children alone. Now we might imagine in our Western ideals, again, that those women and children could have stayed together in their hometown, defended each other and kept themselves safe. But 1 Samuel 30 shows us that's not the reality. What happened there is David and his men were away fighting, and all that happens is when the women and children left alone, raiders just come in and take the women and the children away. It wasn't a safe environment. And we don't know what the wishes of these women are. Grieved by the loss of family and country, left with no protector in a violent land, what would they choose? In the next section, verses 15 to 17, this one's talking about favoritism in polygamous marriages. So here's a law Moses is laying out. And again, it might be a little bit strange to us because we know fine well there shouldn't be any polygamous marriages. From the beginning, it's supposed to be one man cleaving to his wife forever. That's the way that God intended it to be. And in fact, in Jesus' words, in Mark 10, Matthew 19, what Jesus says is that Moses permitted, in that case he was permitting divorce, he permitted divorce because of the hardness of the Israelites' hearts. So this breaking up of the union, which God never wanted, Moses is allowing in Deuteronomy. And what we know, and what I've shown you so far, and again it's shown in this passage we're looking at, is that Deuteronomy and the book of the law is not the ultimate law book. If you follow the rules in here, you cannot think that these things are right and good and make you worthy of heaven. It could never do that, and broken laws like these show it. It's a compromised thing that would allow almost like minimum standards for Israel to exist in order for God to stay with them in that land. But it's not, it falls far short of God's standards. What would happen if they followed this law, which is the intention of Deuteronomy, so Moses lays out at the start, is that they would be very different to the nations around them, nowhere near what God requires them, but they would be different. They'd marked out as being more humane, more honourable and all the rest. But these rules here that are laid out, it's quite clear it's not the ideal. It's not the ideal situation. There shouldn't be polygamous marriages. And Moses is saying, if there are polygamous marriages, if a man has two wives, then favoritism is going to be a problem. Because a man will love one wife more than the other. In fact, we know it was a historical problem. You can think back, Rachel and Leah, Isaac and Ishmael, Joseph and his brothers, Esau and Jacob. There are countless points in their history where they've entered into polygamous marriages, and these problems have come out because of it. And what Moses is saying in our passage here, it's the children that suffer. Moses effectively saying, it just shouldn't happen. You cannot show favoritism, and certainly not based on the whims or the emotions of the fathers. You've got to be realistic and ordered in your approach. Verse 18 to 21, the rebellious son. I'm flying through these because it's hot. So, rebellious son, 18 to 21. What Moses is doing now is continuing this idea. So there's a problem with the inheritance by favouring one son over the other based on the whims of the father. That's what we just read about. We've got to safeguard the land as far as foreign women are coming in. And so here now we've got this passage about the stubborn and rebellious sons, verse 18 to 21. He's warned people about the bad attitudes of parents. Now he's warning about bad attitudes among the children. What's happening is the inheritance is under threat because of the son's behaviour. You can think about a New Testament example. It's a little bit like the prodigal son in Luke 15. The inheritance is under threat because the son is a profligate and a drunkard. He's just going up and spending it all on wild living. And God's respectful ordering and structuring of society is being broken down. That's what the problem is that Moses can anticipate. But more importantly, I think for Moses, it's a direct violation of the fifth commandment. Fifth commandment: honour your father and mother as the Lord your God has commanded you, so that you may live long and that it may go well with you in the land the Lord your God has given you. And so, you can see ironic logic in Moses' instructions in our passage. If you do not honour your mother and father, you will not live long and it will not go well with you in the land. It's like a natural consequence of it. But Moses is clear here, as you look at it. Moses is clear. Because disobedience, this disobedience of the family, of the rebellious son, it's not just a domestic problem. It affects the whole of society around him. It's a community problem. And so what Moses is saying here, the community needs to be called in to deal with it. Verses 19 and 21, take him to the elders of the gate, all the men of the town shall stone him. And in verse 21, we're also told that the death sentence is intended as a deterrent. So we don't like to talk about death sentences now and say they're no deterrent, but quite clearly here in the scripture it says that is what the intention is in verse 21. Now the whole thing sounds harsh, but you can see elements of humanity in here as well. And I'll just point those out to you. In verse 18, the parents, they must have tried everything, but the son just refuses to listen. Absolutely refuses to listen. And then what happens? the parents, as witnesses, they're the ones who must bring him to the elders. Now it's interesting to see that although in verse 18, it's the father is the one who has the rebellious son, but both the father and the mother have to bring this rebellious son to the elders of the town. The mother's testimony, the mother's part that she plays in this, is just as important. And I think there's good reason for that when we get to the New Testament. We go to Ephesians 6 and verse 4. Fathers can have a tendency to exasperate their children. And so, again, there's got to be justice done, so the mother has to come in and be involved in this as well. And but the interesting thing is that unlike the witnesses in Deuteronomy 17:7, the parents are not called to take part in the carrying out of the sentence. They're not the ones that have to kill their son. Still a difficult passage. We're on our closing section, verses 22 and 23. Don't leave the dead hanging. Now, hanging was not a death sentence that was condoned in the Bible. It's another cultural thing from the time. The normal practice in Israel, the normal practice in the cultures around them, was to carry out the death sentence and then take the corpse and hang or impale the body for humiliation. And of course, in the scriptures, you can look at it. So you've got Haman in the book of Esther. You remember that the baker who was imprisoned with Joseph in Egypt. And there were several kings that Joshua hung on trees as warnings and as signs to the people around about them, which you can read about in Joshua. Chapters 8 and 10 tell you those sorts of stories. So that's where the idea is. It's not death by hanging, but it's killing them and then hanging the bodies up on the tree. Now, our translations are not particularly clear. But it's not the hanging that makes a person cursed by God. But what's happened is, because a person is cursed by God, people hang the bodies as a sign of humiliation and the curse. But what God says, what Moses says here in verse 23, is that you can hang the bodies, but don't leave them hanging. Because if you do, it's going to desecrate the land your God has given you as an inheritance. Now, it seems like a fairly clear-cut system and fairly obvious, and you can see obviously the person that was being hanged was clearly guilty of a crime, a capital crime. The death sentence has been carried out according to the law, and all that's happened is you've taken his corpse for a bit of humiliation, hung him on a tree, and, you know, fair dues. You know, maybe what it is maybe what you can think, what's going through the mind. Maybe Moses doesn't want it attacked by the animals, which it would be if it was left up there. But what's interesting, in the New Testament, Peter and Paul both make direct links from Jesus' crucifixion to this verse here in Deuteronomy. In Acts 5:30, in Acts 10:39, in 1 Peter 2:24, Peter refers to Jesus' crucifixion as hanging on a tree. Now, a lot of people have taken those words and they said, oh, maybe what actually happened then was that that on the top of Golgotha, there was an old tree. They cut the branches off and then used to nail the beam up. I've heard that story a few times. But I don't think that's what's actually happening here. And I don't think that's what Peter is doing. I think he's just referring back to Deuteronomy for a particular reason. And I think there's good evidence in that when you get to Galatians 3. Because there, the Apostle Paul also links Jesus' crucifixion directly to this verse. In verse 13, what Paul says is, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who is hung on a tree. What Paul's doing in that passage in Galatians chapter 3, and you can go back and read it and study for yourself, is what he's doing is he explains at the beginning of Galatians 3 that failure to follow the whole of the law results in being cursed. Now, when Paul talks about the failure to follow the whole of the law, what he's actually doing is referring back to Deuteronomy 27:26 and Deuteronomy chapter 1, where we're told that you've got to follow the whole law. You don't add anything to it or take it away, otherwise you're going to be cursed. That's what Paul is referring back to. What Paul also says in Galatians chapter 3, he's showing that righteousness comes by faith, not by trying to follow this law. Just like Paul is explaining, Abraham's righteousness came by faith, because he lived when there was no law, when this law wasn't in existence. And so what Paul is trying to show in that passage is that the promises to Abraham's seed is not promises to Israel, but actually promises to Jesus himself. And so what Paul does is, he goes to show in Galatians 3:14 that what Jesus did was, He redeemed us from the curse of the law, that the blessings given to Abraham might come to the Gentiles. The problem was, for the Gentiles, we couldn't follow this Deuteronomic law. As we said at the start, this law applied to Israel, and the Gentiles couldn't follow it. They weren't a part of it. For a start, they weren't usually circumcised on the eighth day, so they failed in one of the earliest hurdles. So the Gentiles had got no way they were going to be constantly under a curse. And as we read in our passage, if you're under a curse, well, you may as well be hung on a tree to show that you're cursed. But Jesus redeemed us from the curse in order that the blessings given to Abraham might come to the Gentiles. That the inheritance promised to Abraham had to be preserved for Jesus. That's what Moses is trying to guard in this passage. It had to be preserved for Jesus, and Jesus in turn would share that with fellow Jews or Gentiles who believed in him and followed him. And that's what Moses is doing in this passage. These appalling crimes that were carried in the environs around about them, this favoritism that's been shown, this rebellion that we're reading, all of these caused massive problems in the land. And as Moses says, verse 23, you must not desecrate the land the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance. It has to be preserved for Jesus. It has to be preserved for the co-heirs who are with Christ and for us. Amen.